Welcome back to the California Conversation. I'm Tess Abraham. In 21 days, the California Agricultural Land Equity Task Force is required to submit a report to our governor about recommendations to improve land equity across our state. But while they cite that they are trying to right historical injustices and help socially disadvantaged farmers, their recommendations are nothing short of racial discrimination and further regulatory burden on the farming industry. We are breaking it all down today and diving into these very negative policies that would impact farmers across the state of California, and instead how we should be supporting lawmakers to actually support farmers regardless of their race and their identity. But before we get started, make sure to like this video, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already, and ring that notification bell so that you stay up to date on all things California politics. And if you want more information or sources cited in compiling today's episode, then you should check out the corresponding article on my website, which is linked below. All right, welcome back to the show. And today we have so much to cover, so we need to dive directly into it. Now, as I said in my introduction, there's something known as the California Agricultural Land Equity Task Force, and they have a deadline that is coming up in the new year to submit a report to our governor. Now, let's just start off the bat. What is this task force? Well, it was actually developed way back in 2022 by what's known as the California Strategic Growth Council. Whatever that is and whatever they do. And it was actually established as part of the annual budget process. So let me just quote directly from their report when they established the task force. They said, quote, "The task force is made up of 13 appointed members working together to identify and address barriers and opportunities to equitably increase agricultural land access and stable tenure for Native American tribes and socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers in California. The members will submit a report to the legislature and governor by January 1st of 2026 that includes their recommendations on how to address the agricultural land equity crisis." So we see from that their deadline is fast approaching, coming up in just 21 days when this work needs to be completed, and they need to submit a report to Governor Newsom and to our legislature to affect the upcoming laws in 2026. And just an important note, they were given $1 million in order to establish this task force and to do this work. So you might be wondering, what the heck is agricultural land equity and why is it a crisis? Well, once again, let me just quote their words directly to understand where they're coming from and why this initiative was started. They say, quote, "Native American tribes and socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers in California from many backgrounds have faced centuries of systemic discrimination, displacement, and dispossession of their land. The 2022 USDA Census of Agricultural shows that 86% of farms in California are owned by white producers." So there you have it. This is the problem that they have identified. They are upset that the majority of farms across California are owned by white people, and they want to find ways to make it more diverse in the farming community and ensure what they would say is access to agricultural land for what they're defining as socially disadvantaged groups, which they later define as BIPOC, Black, and Latino communities, as well as Native American tribes. And I just want to pause here, and I want to dive in for just a moment on the fact that the task force does not give any explanation for why this is a problem. They just cite the statistic that 86% of farms are owned by white producers, and they assume that you automatically will react to that statistic as saying, well, this is unfair, obviously this is discrimination, and so our state needs to be prioritizing looking into this and how to make it more equitable. But we need to know right off the bat that inequity in something doesn't automatically mean inequality. And the burden of proof is really on the state of California, who is putting money and effort into this initiative to prove why this inequity is a problem that we should be trying to address and solve. So this summer, the task force released a preliminary report with their recommendations, just as they are working through finalizing them. And then obviously the final report will be released in January. And that's the report that I want to go through in detail today, because it gives us insight into what they are going to be telling our legislature to prioritize in 2026. And that can also give us a window into what some new laws might be that are going to be introduced in line with these priority initiatives. And let me just say, the preliminary report is shocking. So buckle up, because there are many recommendations that we need to go through, and just none of them are good, just off the bat. Just telling you that right now. So the task force recommendations fall under a few major goals, and then they have more specific actions within those goals. So let me just break down what these goals are. The first is that they assert that we should be returning ancestral land that is owned by the state of California back to tribal nations. And so what this would do is it would make land back policies. So if you've heard of that, of giving land back to maybe communities or tribes that were here historically before Europeans, land back policies part of the state of California's priority, and it would make it a statewide initiative. And so what this would do is it would take state-owned land and it would transfer it directly to tribal nations. Now, usually when there is some sort of transfer of land or compensation given, how it works, it is given through a third-party intermediary who is known as a land trust. And this is very important because a land trust will actually vet the claims that the tribes are making to the land, and it will see the legitimacy of those claims. And then the land trust will also make sure that it will facilitate any sort of payment, facilitate anything, any money that's exchanging hands, as well as the land that is actually going to the tribe. Now, what this recommendation does is it wants to completely cut out that process. So it wants to facilitate the transfer of state-owned land to tribal nations without a third party and without any sort of compensation given. So the tribes do not need to pay for this land. They don't need to do anything to obtain this land. They just make claim to the land, and then the land will go directly from the state to them. But this is problematic. And it's problematic for the few reasons that we just discussed. There is no one to vet any sort of claim that is given to the land. And then there is no one to also step in when complexities inevitably are going to arise. So this report focuses on a very broad requirement of handing over land to tribes, but this obviously leaves a lot of questions. Questions like, what happens to current leaseholders? Some people lease land from the state. What is going to happen to those people when the land is given to tribes? What happens to the public's right of access? So think of things like state parks or trails or camping areas. What is going to happen to those areas if tribes are laying claim to them? Additionally, how do tribal governments handle environmental regulation? A lot of tribes are not under the same regulatory burden that the rest of farmers are under in terms of CEQA, as well as state resource protections. And so how is the state going to deal with that? If California really thinks that environmental protections are a right and a responsibility of our state, how are they going to handle that when people now have access to land and they are not under the same protections? What about revenues? We know that state lands generate income, and when that income is now just cut out, that is going to affect local counties. It's going to affect school districts. It's going to affect the state general fund, so much more. But the report does not give any sort of fiscal impact analysis. How are overlapping claims resolved? California has so many different tribal nations, and not surprisingly, a lot of them lay claim to the same areas. And so on a map, a lot of them overlap. So what's going to happen when you have multiple tribes who are laying claim to the same areas or areas that intersect with one another? If now there's not even a third party to establish which tribe has which right to which land, it just becomes a disaster. And then ultimately, what precedent does this set? If we are saying that you have identity-based entitlement to land because of some affiliation or association with a tribal nation that goes back to predate America or predate California, then what is going to stop similar claims from other groups, other historical communities, other descendants of displaced communities? Where is it going to end? So we see that this is the first main objective or recommendation of the report, and already it's a complete disaster. And I just want to point out, they again had 3 years to hammer this out. They did not go into the intricacies of how these things are going to be addressed. And so obviously it is just off the bat, a complete joke. But it gets worse. So that's the first objective. The second objective is to do what's known as conserving agricultural land in California. And that sounds really good. We want to conserve agricultural land. We need it. We want farmers to have it. And so this in theory should be a great thing. But when you look in practice as what they're trying to put in place to actually do this conservation, you can see that it is something entirely different. And so first of all, it once again is going to prioritize certain racial or identity groups. And so it is, instead of just conserving land, it's limiting access to who is able to buy, who is able to lease this private land. As if that wasn't bad enough, it also requires mandatory conservation easements on farmland. Now, an easement restricts what you're able to do. And so an easement would actually set what the purpose of the farmland is and what farmers are able to do on the land that they are farming. And so usually once land is locked under an easement for whatever set period of time that it's locked under, you can't change how the land is going to be used. And so that means that farmers lose the ability to quickly adapt, to innovate, to be able to change uses of their land and to improve their operations. And so the report doesn't talk about how this restrictions are going to actually affect farmers and farms, as well as economic viability as farmers try to make sure that their operations are keeping up with what the needs are demanding. Another component is that they want to lease out 300,000 acres of state-owned grazing land at rates that are so low they don't even cover the expenses that go into managing the farmland. And so what this would mean is that taxpayers are actually going to subsidize the cost of those under-market leases, and as well as the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife, because they actually largely manage the land, they're just going to foot the bill for this. And then lastly, they want to also propose zoning changes that, again, are going to limit what owners can do on their land, which then is going to actually lower land value. Because if you tell farmers what they can and can't do with their land, then the land is going to actually go down in value because they can't diversify, they can't identify new opportunities. And that would also mean that as land value goes down, that local tax revenues are also going to go down, which again impacts local districts as well as school districts. So it's just a complete and utter mess. There is so much here that they have not addressed. And really, the biggest problem with this so-called land conservation is that they don't actually prove that the people who are gaining access to this land are going to actually be able to successfully run farms. It's just identity-based. It's racially-based, but they're not actually seeing if the land is going to stay productive under these new limits. And so essentially, they don't have any evidence for why this is going to help conserve farmland. They're just making a lot of statements of what they think that you should do without backing it up with clear evidence as to what has worked in the past, what has worked in other states or maybe even other countries. And so they just assert that this is their version of conservation. And the last objective I want to look at, there are several more objectives, but the last one is more an overarching theme, and that is the recommendation to change the zoning and land right laws to favor so-called socially disadvantaged farmers. The main way that they want to do this is they want to work with local governments to change those zoning laws to actually restrict who is able to lease and purchase property, once again favoring racial minorities. And so we see that changes like this would obviously distort the market for land. It would limit land access. It would mean that the government is coming in and dictating who can buy, who can lease for how long, what you can do. And it wants to change that through local laws. And so I think among all of these recommendations, the most egregious point to understand is one that I kind of touched on earlier, but that is that there is no evidence to show that helping to diversify quote-unquote land equity actually is going to improve farming outcomes. So there's no evidence that shows increased crop yields or improved soil health or better ecological outcomes or stronger farm profitability. None of that. They don't talk about any of that. They just once again like to play on things like historical inequities that make you think that these are problems that need to actually be resolved. But they don't have any data to prove why it's a problem in the first place. So I want to go back to something I mentioned. I mentioned that inequity doesn't automatically mean inequality. And so when we think about this statistic, this 86% of farms that are owned by white people versus the remaining 14% owned by other racial minorities, we need to think about this in light of other industries as well, because again, it doesn't mean that there's automatically injustice being done. And so when you think about something like the mining community, think of who are miners. Well, that community is largely male. If you look at it, about 90% of the farming or the mining community is male dominated and females are not in this industry. Does that mean that the mining industry as a whole is just automatically sexist? No. I mean, maybe these people would argue that it is sexist, but we know that that's not the case. It means that women have the choice to choose a different career trajectory. And so when we look at things even like farming, yes, in California, it seems like a lot of farmland is owned by majority white people, but that does not automatically mean that that is due to a systemic problem or due to a law that is in place that is holding back racial minorities from purchasing agricultural land and farming it out. It just means that there are other factors at play in the same way that there are factors at play with why women choose certain careers and men choose other certain careers. And so one thing to think about is that farmland is largely inherited. And so this doesn't only have to affect racial groups, this just affects people in general. I don't own a farm. I would actually love to own a farm. And I told my husband for Christmas this year that is on my wish list if he wants to buy me a bunch of acres of farmland, but I don't own a farm. And largely I don't because one, I live in Los Angeles, and so it's not really a great area to be farming. But two, California land is really expensive. And so to make the necessary sacrifices in order to move somewhere that I could actually afford a farmland, as well as spending our money on renovating and fixing up a farm, is just the cost that I don't want to pay. It's not the path that I'm going down with my life. And so that is where I am. But I know people who have inherited farmland or who have inherited more property because their parents or the generations before them were farmers. And so that just affects people. It affects the lifestyle choices that their parents made. It affects the choices of where you want to live. And so when we start to look at racial groups, we also see that there is a disparity in where certain racial groups live. We see, especially in Los Angeles, that a lot more racial minorities move into more urban centers. For maybe different factors than is what is being proposed by this task force. And so to ignore the fact that choice exists, to ignore the fact that there are many different factors at play with who chooses to go into the farming industry is downright wrong. And then on top of that, to propose these recommendations that are largely racially driven is also wrong. Proponents of land equity would say that it is wrong to favor one racial group over another. They think that it's wrong if white people have more favor to be able to own farms than what they consider to be racial minorities. But they are trying to fix the problem by actually going back to the actual problem. They want to favor certain racial groups over another racial group, namely over white people. And so trying to fix what you see as injustice by furthering the injustice in the opposite direction is not the correct solution. So when we think about these recommendations that are being made by the task force, there are serious constitutional and moral implications that we need to think through. But there are just so many issues at play that it feels really overwhelming to respond. So I'm going to break this down for you. First, let's look at the issue of land redistribution back to Native American tribes or communities, because that in itself is a whole separate issue from some of the other things at play. So the draft report cites more than two centuries of land theft, violence, and discrimination, as well as historical injustices as the basis for the idea of redistributing land to tribal nations. And it's actually interesting, the report cites the phrase cultural humility over five times in it, saying that that is how we need to approach certain issues like tribal lands. We just need to have cultural humility when looking at the past. So I pose the question, do we just need to have cultural humility when granting land to tribal nations? Should we feel guilty about California's past or America's past and let that guilt drive our policy positions? I would obviously argue no. And so let me give you some guiding principles for how to think about the stolen land narrative. First of all, land ownership is a fundamental pillar of liberty here in America. It is deeply important for citizens and for residents wherever they live to be able to own the land that they live on, and especially in the industry of agriculture that they faithfully farm. And so any policy changes that are going to change the ability for people to own land, that is going to restrict people from owning land, is something that we should take very seriously and that should raise a lot of questions in our mind, and we should be very suspicious or skeptical of. And so under the current rule of law in our country, our legal frameworks, treaties, contracts, leases, titles, all of those things matter. Policies that rely on more vague historical grievances without clear legal claims, like these titles and things that we talked about, are often a sign of current injustice that is being done simply for the sake of virtue signaling about some past injustice that they are claiming. And so as we think about tribal matters, there are actually different categories of tribal claims that we can look at of how we should be responding to them and then see where they fall in terms of the recommendations of this task force. So the first is actual treaty obligations. If the United States government or our state government has an actual written treaty with a tribe, then our government should actually make good on that promise. That would be a legally binding contract. And so the United States government should not break that. And if they do, then there needs to be some restitution paid for it. Now, usually restitution looks like fair compensation for the value of the land. So we don't often see this just wholesale transfer of land to Native American tribes. Rather, it would usually be through just compensation, and that would be settled through court or through an intermediary. But the basic idea is looking at the actual contractual obligations that the government has toward these Native American tribes and then making good on those obligations. What it does not do is just rely on vague historical guilt. But that's what we see that the task force is doing. They actually don't point out any sort of treaties or contracts that have been broken with certain tribes and say, that is why we need to be giving land to them. Instead, they just rely again on these vague claims of broad injustice that was done. But then the question becomes, where does it end? If you can just continually claim injustice, but you don't actually prove a legal right to that land, then is there ever going to be an end to it? Or are we always in perpetuity going to be owing land to someone? The second category is an individual claim of injustice. And so this would be an actual tribe or an actual person who is saying that they had a legal claim to the land and now that land has been taken from them. And again, this is very similar to the first category. If there was an individual claim that was broken, then that can be settled through our justice system. We have a court system. We have a system for being able to show contracts and show evidence of legal claim. And so these can be resolved via litigation. And again, there will often be direct compensation for formal and legally evidenced claims. But again, when we look at the California Agricultural Land Equity Task Force, such a mouthful, we see that it is not doing this either. It is going off of group-based generational claims rather than individual claims of even just specific Native American tribes. And so this is a retroactive collective reparations model. But we see that it has nothing to do with tangible, legally proven harms. And then the third category, and this category is probably most of what they would try to group all of their recommendations under. The last category is present-day tribal sovereignty. And so our state has allowed for self-governance of certain tribes. And whether you agree with that or not, there are existing reservations. They do have some level of freedom. Like I mentioned earlier, under certain regulations, they're not bound the same way. And so you might support, in some cases, deregulating tribal business or making sure that they don't have to abide by those regulations. But this does not mean that there has to just be mass redistribution of state-owned land to anyone who lays claim to it. And it also does not mean that we have to force our communities who are not part of Native American communities to bear the cost of this quote-unquote historical healing that they're saying needs to happen. So really what we see in all of these potential situations that are related to tribal claims is that they should be treated on an individual basis and they should be based on evidence. They should have to prove some sort of claim. They should be handled individually, not just collectively mass giving a lot of land to anyone who lays claim to it. But when talking about this issue, we need to take it even a step further because tangible land disputes aren't the only thing that are at play here. And we know that because they continue to cite broad historical grievance. The reason that they do this is that guilt is a very powerful thing. And so it is very easy to make someone feel guilty for an injustice that they had no part in doing or they had no hand in creating. And so we need to be honest about the past, and we need to also be honest about the present. We shouldn't rely on collective guilt in order to make policy positions, but we should continue to move forward in the present day, looking at how certain situations are today and righting wrongs that are happening in real time. And so I just want to say that every group in human history has experienced conquest, migration, and displacement. There is no region on Earth, including the Americas, that has just always been a static map of permanent, unchanging ownership. It has been the history of the world. It has been the history of the tribes even before the Americas were found by Europeans. Before they arrived, indigenous groups were not a single unified nation. They had a lot of different land disputes. And usually the tribes that conquered and took the land were the ones who then laid claim to it and had ownership of it. And so if historical displacement is going to be the standard for restitution, then every tribe who was displaced by another tribe still has claim to that land that they were displaced from. And so again, the question becomes, where is it going to end? Who is going to be able to be higher up in the hierarchy of claims to the land? How far back are we going to go? How are we going to adjudicate these land claims with often very little evidence because it was so long ago? The reality is that you cannot unwind history and you cannot restore every single person back to the piece of land that they started on. It's just not possible. So instead, modern governments should be focusing on current laws, current issues of the day, and making sure that every people group does have rights, making sure that people are able to own land regardless of what identity group that they are a part of and regardless of what their history was. And really, this leads into the main problem with these recommendations, and that is that they are largely driven by race-based discrimination. And so whether we see that with tribal communities of just identifying with a certain Native American tribe as now you're entitled to land, or we see that with what they mentioned with BIPOC, Black or Latino communities as these socially disadvantaged groups, it is all based on race. But we know that that is not allowed in America today under our constitution, in California under our state constitution. And so there are just a lot of issues that this runs up in against. And so if we look at the 14th Amendment, we see that it says the government cannot treat people differently based on race unless there is a compelling state interest and the policy is narrowly tailored. So that means that California not only needs to prove that there are current disparities in land ownership, they need to show that they are directly tied to intentional discrimination by the state. And not only that, not only intentional discrimination, but that the new rules that they're putting in place are the literal only way to rectify or solve that discrimination. They have not proven that burden. But we can even take it a step further because it's not only the 14th Amendment that speaks to this, it's our state's own constitution. So Proposition 209 added Article 1, Section 31 to the California Constitution, which says, quote, the state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public employment, public education, or public contracting. And a lot of this farmland and these agricultural considerations fall under that last category of public contracting. And so our state constitution is even clearer and even more specific than the federal constitution or the 14th Amendment on this issue. They cannot make these considerations. They cannot talk about leases. They cannot talk about contracts or make any of that based on race. It needs to be applied equally to all citizens. And yet we see that these new agricultural recommendations explicitly do exactly just that. They prioritize grants, leases, and zoning access for certain racial groups. So when you hear this task force talk about equity, what they're really doing is embedding race-based discrimination into modern-day agricultural land practices. And that doesn't only go against the federal constitution or even our state's constitution, but also just basic principles of fairness and equality and property rights that every single Californian depends on. And so this means that next year, if these recommendations are made and if our legislature follows them, we are going to see new laws roll out in accordance with these recommendations that inevitably are going to get tied up in court because they are illegal. And so that means that it's going to waste years of time. It is going to use court energy and it is going to distract our legislature in trying to pass these laws that are just going to get struck down by a court. And it's also going to waste taxpayer dollars in fighting them in court. So it's just all a complete mess and a complete waste. Now, the last point that we have to consider on this topic is that these land equity recommendations are coming to California at a time when current California farmers are already facing severe challenges. And so in the five-year period from 2017 to 2022, California saw a 10.5 5% decline in State Farms. And that was due to certain situations like water shortages, regulatory burden, and soaring compliance costs, as they have risen over 1,400% for growers over the past 2 decades. So California farms are shutting down. They are in crisis. They cannot keep up with the rising costs of compliance, as well as all of the regulatory burden that is put on them with environmental regulations and other regulations. And so what they choose to do is leave the state. They either just shut down the farm and walk away, or they move their farm to a different state. That's a very serious problem. And California needs to follow the data. If we are seeing these hundreds of thousands of farms closing year over year, we need to start asking questions like, why are they closing? Not asking questions like, who owns these farms and how can we diversify them? And this affects you. This affects me. Because per the U.S. Department of Agriculture, dairy production has declined in California in the last 20 years, with the number of dairy cows decreasing by 160,000 since 2008. And there are so many more different areas that are going to be impacted by this. When farms close, we lose access to the goods that they produced. We lose access to their outputs. That's going to drive up costs as we rely more on imports. That's going to hurt even other states, as we are a big exporter. We are such a powerhouse in California for the agricultural economy. And so this has real life impact on you and me. This is not just a hypothetical issue, and this doesn't just affect people who own the farms. Additionally, since the 1980s, we have lost 7.95 million acres of farmland. And that land has been lost not due to people leaving farms, not due to personal choice. That has been lost due to large-scale renewable energy projects. So think of solar and wind farms that have been pursued by the state of California because they are cleaner energy. Regulations like the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, restricted farmland for ecological purposes like salmon recovery, if that sounds familiar to you, and further regulatory and economic pressure. So again, policy has a huge impact on daily life, and policy related to agriculture and farmland has a huge impact on agricultural land. And so again, rather than worrying about who owns the land, we should just be worried about the fact that we are losing this land because of the very policies that are being put in place by our state. But instead, the state is now seeking to introduce new policies that are going to limit agricultural and farming abilities even further. And that means that more farmers are going to walk away or just be restricted from farming in the first place. Farming is not a social experiment. It is not a diversity initiative. It is not a symbolic gesture. Farming is an economic system that feeds the millions of people who live in our state, as well as helps to support the economy in the rest of the country. And so we depend on these farmers for our food. We depend on them to continue supporting our state's economy as we export food. And we cannot just be playing identity politics with it. They have a real consequences. This just shows us once again that our current legislature and the people who are in charge of governing us are just completely detached from reality, and they actually often make the problems worse. And so as this report is being ready to be released in just 21 days, we must urge our lawmakers to reject the recommendations of this task force. We must urge them to support our farmers to help expand agriculture in our state. And the way that they expand it is not through racial discrimination. It is not through these identity politics. It's through deregulation. It's through getting out of farmers' ways and letting them do what they know how to do, how they have already stewarded their land so well, and enabling them to continue doing that. And this is important because unless we change, we are going to wake up one day and realize the very people that we pushed out of the ability to be here, of the ability to be able to farm our land, are the very people who we depended on the most. Thank you so much for joining me here today. I hope it was helpful for you as you navigate life in our state and that you even learned something new. Please spread the word and share this show with your friends, family, and fellow Californians. And I'll see you back here next week for another episode of the California Conversation.